This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, we're in the season of giving thanks, and it seems with so much going on in the world, we have much to be truly thankful for here in our country.
Well, we do indeed, Mark, but our hearts go out to the victims of the Paris attacks, as well as all of those refugees in search of a place to call home. I think it adds a special poignance this year as American families gather safely around their holiday tables during this holiday season to think about so many that don't have a home.
Absolutely. And meanwhile, the Surgeon General and the Department of Health and Human Services want to remind folks that Thanksgiving is also National Family History Day, a great time to collect the family's health history.
Well, you know, a recent survey showed that while most Americans believe it's important to know your family history, only about a third of Americans actually do. And for many families, it's just never occurred to them to ask about past generations of loved ones and what health issues might have befallen them.
There's actually a guide you can download from the Department of Health and Human Service website. Just go to familyhistory.hhs.org. A simple template is provided to guide families through the process of collecting that family health history and making it available to future generations. So pass the cranberries and also grab the app.
It could go a long way in helping families, and especially the younger generations, understand what health risks they might face down the line and also how to make better use of preventive measures and screenings to reduce risk and improve their own health and future.
The future of healthcare is on the mind of our guest today. Chris Trimble is an expert in organizational innovation. He has since turned his attention to innovation in the healthcare industry.
Chris will be talking about his most recent book, How Physicians Can Fix Healthcare One Innovation at a Time.
Lori Robertson stops by. The managing editor of FactCheck.org is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
And no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Chris Trimble in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. Men's health and cancer screenings. Prostate screenings are down, and so is cancer detection. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommended in 2012 an end to regular screening for heightened PSA levels in men, saying at the time the risks outweighed the benefits of the blood test. The theory behind the recommendation is that prostate cancers grow very slowly and might never harm the patient, but all are treated and often with rigorous and life-altering treatments, exposing too many men, they say, to radiation and incontinence and other side effects. Experts in urology fear the pendulum has swung too far in the wrong direction and not enough screenings are being ordered now. There's been a 7% drop in just a couple of years in the numbers of men over 50 being given those routine screenings, and diagnoses are down by tens of thousands of patients. With actor Charlie Sheen's recent disclosure that he was HIV positive, it's put the disease on the front burner as we approach World AIDS Day. While HIV has become a disease of medical management, there's far less fear in certain populations, and there are still some 50,000 new diagnoses each year, especially among young men of color. Meanwhile, HIV-positive folks who purchase the most popular silver plans on the federal insurance marketplaces are finding it harder to access the drugs required to hold the disease in check. In 31 states and District of Columbia, out-of-pocket costs for purchasing these drugs can run into the thousands. Meanwhile, the cost of drugs are increasingly driving the cost of overall health in this country. There's also a global impact. A survey shows by the year 2020, the world will spend $1.5 trillion on prescription drugs. In 2015, the number was just over $1 trillion. And Texas has been hard at work trying to shut down Planned Parenthood, the only access to family planning and basic health services for hundreds of thousands of mostly poor women. And that limited access is having an ancillary effect. An estimated 240,000 Texas women have resorted to attempting self-induced abortions. Health officials warn this is a crisis in the making. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're We're speaking today with Chris Trimble, author of How Physicians Can Fix Healthcare, One Innovation at a Time. Mr. Trimble is an expert on innovation within established organizations with a more recent focus on healthcare industry. He's a professor in the Master's in Healthcare Delivery Science program at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business, and he's advised a number of Fortune 100 companies on innovation strategies, including Microsoft, AT&T, and GE. A prolific writer, Mr. Trimble also co-wrote Beyond the Idea, How to Execute Innovation in Any Organization, as well as the McKinsey Award-winning Stop the Innovation Awards in the Harvard Business Review. He served as a nuclear submarine officer in the U.S. Navy, earned his Bachelor's of Science in Mechanical Engineering at the University of Virginia, and his MBA at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth. Mr. Trimble, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks very much, Mark. It's great to be here.
Love the line in the book about your ability to walk through a submarine blindfolded and be able to sort of do anything. Now, you've been really engaged in innovation. You know, it's a challenge for any organization. How do you innovate, continue to serve your customer base, and keep their businesses moving forward? And you've been looking also at large organizations, as we just said, GE, Microsoft, and eBay. But now you're starting to make this shift over to healthcare with the Affordable Care Act and just changes in the business climate, going through enormous policy and care delivery side change. So a great time to bring the skill sets around innovation. Could you describe for our listeners your focus on healthcare and how your innovation principles were adapted to fit to the unique challenges in the industry?
I sure can, Mark. You know, you described what I've been doing very well. I've been studying for many, many years why it's so hard for organizations to innovate, and it's because there's so much conflict between what already exists, ongoing operations and innovation, and that much is the same in the industry as it is in healthcare. I'd been looking for an opportunity to really dig my teeth into an issue of social significance where innovation was going to play a big role. And so healthcare just called out to me that way as the perfect chance. And I'd say when I first came into it, I probably underestimated just how complicated and unusual and peculiar an industry it is. And so it did take some time and some effort to figure out how to customize what I had developed for any industry to the specific challenges of healthcare. But I just found I loved the challenge of getting to know a profession I've long admired, the medical profession, and learn how to work with and communicate with physicians in particular, and hopefully provide some helpful guideposts towards making innovation happen.
Well, Chris, you know, in your book, you made a great observation that when penicillin was discovered, it delivered a double win for the healthcare industry. We had not only a vastly improved chance of survival of infection, so much better health outcomes, but you've made the observation now that the 21st century double win isn't going to come from a pill or a device, but will come from breakthroughs in care delivery innovation, maybe through what we call implementation science here in our organization. And you've also said you see reverse innovation playing a great role. Tell us what you mean by that, and maybe give us some examples. What are these double wins of the 21st century that we're likely to see?
There may still be double wins where we get both an increase in outcomes and a decrease in costs from the same medical innovation. But it's pretty clear that if you look at innovation or biosciences-driven innovation in aggregate, the curve is flattened out, which is to say we're spending a lot more and the gains are getting ever more marginal. I bet that most everyone can think up at least one recently released pharmaceutical that is only marginally better than its predecessor and yet costs far more. Those double wins in the biosciences are very rare, and we shouldn't feel badly about that. Every industry you'll ever look at, and this is well documented, innovation trajectories tend to get flatter over time. And what that means is we have to look in an entirely new area for double wins, and that new area is innovation in healthcare delivery. This is a pretty unique opportunity in healthcare. There are opportunities for double wins all over the country and in every medical condition, and yet we've been sitting on these for decades, in part because we're very understandably obsessed with advances in the biosciences. but also because of fee-for-service medicine. Fee-for-service medicine stands in the way the majority of the time of innovations in healthcare delivery. And so we've been missing these opportunities for a long, long time, and there's no greater reason to feel optimistic about the future of healthcare than the steady and even accelerating transition we're making to accountable care and to value-based payments. This will open the door for innovation in healthcare delivery as never before. The only question is, will we recognize it as innovation? Very often, these innovations are based on common sense principles that we talk about a lot, like coordination of care or better prevention for populations that are at high risk. And they may not represent intellectual breakthroughs, but they do deliver that dramatic double win. So to finish your question, you asked about reverse innovation, and this refers to innovation in the developing world and the increasing prevalence of innovations that are adopted first in the developing world. Mm-hmm. And we're seeing that in all industries. I think the sort of underlying force is very easy to grasp. Here in the United States, we need to find ways to deliver higher quality care at lower cost. Why wouldn't we look for inspiration to nations around the world that have struggled with minimal resources for decades?
Chris, I really like your mountain climbing analogy when you're referring to innovation of any kind. And you say that amateur innovators cheer when they get to the top of the mountain, and when the experienced innovator knows to wait until they've gotten back down. Talk to our listeners about this cycle of organizational innovation and where the pitfalls are generally lurking in the process of not only innovation, but implementation of these new ideas.
Innovation is like that, and the summit moment is that moment when you come up with a new idea. And unfortunately, when organizations get excited about innovation, they tend to imagine that if they can just come up with that breakthrough new idea, the rest will be a snap. More often than not, that's just wrong. The idea is the easy part, and that's particularly true for innovation in healthcare delivery because we're talking about ideas that have been around for a long time, like standardization of care processes or coordination of care. These are not complicated ideas in the least. They're just ideas that we've sat on.
Actually, the pace of innovation has been accelerating, but the premise of your book is that clinicians innovating on the front lines of care delivery, that they all hold a key or part of the key to meaningfully transforming healthcare. Tell us how clinicians should be thinking about fostering innovation. Tell us why appointing a designated team is an essential first step.
One of the themes of the book is that there are a whole lot of even nearer at hand innovations that we've not capitalized on that are lower risk, have a higher probability of payoff. Wouldn't be a shame if we've got so absorbed in the possibilities of new technology that we overlooked the lower-hanging fruit. You're absolutely right. There is a role for all in innovation. It's just that physician leadership is a particularly essential element. Many organizations in healthcare for many years have been investing in continuous improvement, but there's a physical limit to how far most continuous improvement or quality improvement programs can go because they are designed to squeeze innovation into little pieces of slack time in the organization. It's everybody's part-time job. Mm-hmm. Something really important happens when you commission a dedicated full-time team for a single innovation initiative. But the other part that's a little bit more subtle but extremely important is that suddenly you have a whole new degree of flexibility, and that is you can rethink from scratch what everybody's job is. And team redesign is at the very core of innovation in healthcare delivery.
We're speaking today with Chris Trimble, author of How Physicians Can Fix Healthcare. He's a professor in the Master's in Healthcare Delivery Science program at Dartmouth's Tuck School of Business. Chris, you know, we've been very engaged in these clinical microsystems, really something that came out of Dartmouth. But it's all about a partnership within the organization, and that's, I think you've said, is where the challenge lies. Talk about this larger partnership that you envision.
To talk about the power of a dedicated team is indeed to oversimplify. That is a critical step to take, but these teams never work in isolation. And so what you end up with is what I describe as a partnership between a dedicated team and a shared staff. And while the dedicated team has, at least in theory, infinite flexibility, the shared staff has almost no flexibility. They are already locked in to their existing care models and care processes and already have extremely busy schedules. So treating the shared staff well is something of an art. You have to make it as easy as possible for the shared staff to contribute to the innovation. And, of course, you want to share credit with the shared staff at every opportunity you get and make it feel like the victory is theirs as well as it is that of the dedicated team.
Well, Chris, you've also said that there's, in your research and estimation, might really only be a couple of hundred systems across the country that are really ahead of the curve in implementing breakthrough innovation. Maybe tell us about a few of those systems across the country that you think are really ahead of the curve in implementing breakthrough innovations, and maybe a few words about what those innovations are that so impress you.
Sure. So you're absolutely right in saying that the commissioning of small full-time teams has not been the norm in healthcare. Probably the most important unexpected step that I am pushing for and asking senior leaders in health systems to make is to commission those teams far more often than they are today. I think that what you have in healthcare is a knee-jerk reaction to doing so that is really the residue of our fee-for-service mindset. Once we get past that, what we're going to see is our very modest size risks with a high probability of return. And in fact, these risks are paltry when compared to other risks that healthcare leaders are quite accustomed to, like building new buildings or new wings on a hospital or even merging with a rival across town. I would say there's not 100 systems across the country that are doing this well. I'd say there's none. There are 100 or a couple of hundred examples of projects that have happened one way or another because of a single committed senior leader that wanted to see it happen, or because the project was grant-funded in some way, had some other special source of funding. One that I talk about frequently is from Salt Lake City and Primary Children's Hospital in particular, which is run jointly by Intermountain Healthcare and the University of Utah. Here, the population, the patient population of interest is children with complex medical conditions, and yet they're overwhelmed. And very often it's the case that they're given conflicting advice from multiple caregivers that are working with them. So the innovation leader in this case was Dr. Nancy Murphy, who started recognizing the ways that the system fell short for these families as early as her residency. And she had the chance to build a small clinic. It was a dedicated team, a small full-time team of four people. And because it was a dedicated team, they had the flexibility to reinvent what they do at work every day. And what they created was a clinic in which every appointment is quite lengthy, 60 minutes, even 90 minutes, and during which time you might see, in fact, you were likely to see all four members of Murphy's team. Up to four families might be in the clinic at one time. At the end of the 60 or 90-minute session, they would all huddle and share insights and recommendations, and then go back and have one final discussion with the families. These families they have a lot to think about, and they're often dealing with trauma. And so more than a third of the clinic's time was left free of appointments to enable ample bandwidth for phone calls, for email, for follow-up both with the families and the others that were involved in the care. The result? Well, patients and their families were far more satisfied, and despite the extra that was spent in this clinic, costs overall to the system were down by well over 10%. So I tell you, that I've shared this story a lot, and very often the reaction is a bit understated. And it was an accurate recognition that there was no intellectual breakthrough here, and what this was simply more time for care planning and care coordination. And that is exactly right. In fact, that's the point. We can get dramatic double wins through the proper application of common sense ideas that have been around for a long time. Anybody that can deliver a dramatic double win is a hero in my book.
And some seem to hold promise. Wide waterfront of devices out there, self-tracking, telemedicine, remote monitoring. But I'm wondering if you could talk about how these emerging technologies may or may not accelerate the pace of care delivery innovation, and what's your research telling you?
I think they will help transform healthcare. I just don't know how. I don't think anybody knows how yet. How important, say, a wearable device or some of the new cell phone apps are going to be, or some of the new telemedicine technologies are going to be. And I'm not going to judge whether high tech is more important than the low tech stuff that I'm writing about. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably value to be gained across the board. I will repeat my big fear, and that is we'll get so carried away with our infatuation with science and technology that we'll overlook the opportunities mm-hmm. that are very near at hand.
Mm-hmm. We've been speaking today with Chris Trimble, innovation expert and author of How Physicians Can Fix Healthcare One Innovation at a Time. You can learn more about his work by going to exec.tuck.dartmouth.edu/news, or you can follow him on Twitter at @Trimble_Chris. Chris, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you very much.
Great. At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Hillary Clinton claimed that a recent study showed white middle-aged Americans without a high school education are dying earlier than their parents and their grandparents. One of the authors of that study told us it, quote, doesn't establish any of what she says. The study found an increased mortality rate among that age group since 1999, but it made no comparisons with past generations. The study was written by two Princeton economists, Angus Deaton and Ann Case, and published online November 2nd by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. It found that the mortality rate for non-Hispanic whites 45 to 54 years old has increased by 34 deaths per 100,000 people from 1999 to 2013, reversing a, quote, remarkable long-term decline in mortality rates in the United States. That increase was driven primarily by those with a high school degree or less. The mortality rate for that group during that time increased by 134 deaths per 100,000. One of the authors, Deaton, told us in an email that the study did not say anything about people without a high school education, as Clinton claimed. More important, the study didn't make comparisons with past generations. Clinton claimed that the study shows middle-aged Americans are dying earlier than their parents and grandparents. Deaton says the study doesn't look at that question at all. And he told us that he would be surprised if her claim were true, especially for grandparents, given the general decline in mortality prior to 1999. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Falling is a common experience among the elderly, and that is not good news.
Hip fractures in the elderly are an enormous, devastating, expensive death sentence of an injury. If you're over 65 and you've fallen and broken your hip, 25% of them will die within 12 months. Another 25% will never be able to live independently, and a full 75% will never regain full mobility.
That statistic got former airbag executive Drew Lucatos thinking, what if you could apply the technology used in airbags to create wearable devices that protect a person from the impact of falling?
So our government has spent billions in about two decades on fall prevention programs for the elderly. What I'm suggesting is we make that same strategic shift that the auto industry did, and we begin focusing on intelligent protection of our elderly.
So they did their research and found a combination of accelerometers and other sensors on the band worn around the waist could deploy within 6 milliseconds of sensing an imminent fall, significantly reducing the blow to the joint.
With the right technology, we can ensure that these people that meet that inevitable, immovable object, which is the floor, can not only survive that accident, they can walk away. With this type of technology, we can protect against concussions. We can now protect Coumadin patients. We can protect our military soldiers from IEDs.
A simple retooling of airbag technology leading to better health outcomes, lower health costs, and better quality of life. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.